Giselle and Unicorns and Rosie McKinnon, and thrilled to have Neil St. Clair on the podcast today. Thank you, Neil, for joining us.
More than my extreme pleasure. Thanks for wearing the sunglasses with me. And we both have like similar hairstyles. We got the.
I do. Yeah.
There
you go.
Looking good.
So Neil, you have an amazing career, amazing background. Can you tell us about it?
Yeah. So here's the 45-second strange arc. You know, at the end of the day, despite everything, I'm just a high-class Jersey boy. That is always who I am. So life started there in Jersey, Boston University, Yale University for my education. Started life as a television journalist, on-camera television reporter for New York One and a couple of other places. But, you know, at a certain point, there was a quote that was bouncing around in my head from Winston Churchill. And I know it's a little passe to quote Churchill these days, but the quote still stands. And it says, there comes a certain point in every person's life where they must stop taking the news and start making it to be an actor and not a critic. And so I said, you know, I want to stop telling other people's stories and write one of my own. So as much as anyone becomes an entrepreneur, became an entrepreneur, started my first company at about 24 years old, incubated while I was at Yale University, a company called Unbuy That. And I always say first companies are like first loves. You're probably not going to get married to them, but they always hold a soft spot in your heart. So I still like to talk about it. Company was an abject failure, but learned a lot, rolled it right into my next company, which was successful, a company called Alleywire. It's the first ever video news service covering Silicon Alley, New York's tech scene. Ran that successfully for 3 years, and then decided to go up to Boston after leaving Alleywire to take over as the first ever director of marketing for a $12 billion investment firm up there called Shepherd Kaplan. While I was there, also founded an insurance technology company called Thrice, one of the first ever data platforms for the insurance brokerage property and casualty real estate space. Weird little niche, but we built it in-house for somebody who did a nice job of that. Came back to New York, started working for an artificial intelligence SaaS startup called Vesterly. Helped them raise a few $1 million of venture capital. We were cooking with gas. I was really excited there. I was the chief growth officer. And then a billionaire, $20 billion family actually tapped me on the shoulder and said, hey, we hear you know a thing or two about media. Would you come help one of our young family principals potentially build a media company? He has a lot of ideas, fair amount of funds, but hasn't really operated that much before. So I came in as his president. We built something together called Karma or Karma Impact. Ran that for about 3 years as the president, a couple of other subsidiary organizations, did a lot of social impact investing. Karma Impact was specifically focused on covering impact and impact investment for the next generation. So for entrepreneurs like myself or for inheritors of great wealth, really a first of its kind to do that. And still going strong today, the vision changed a little bit from being a video first platform to more sort of like an economist for social impact, but still going very strong today. But, you know, similar to my earlier career where I said, man, you know, like I want to stop telling stories and start making stories. I decided I didn't want to cover social impact anymore. I wanted to do impact as much as anyone ever does impact. So I stepped out of Karma and its parent company, Timeless Media, and decided to go work for a friend of mine that was already on her advisory board, a young woman named Rachelea Bernstein. She's the daughter of the founder of the investment bank, Alliance Bernstein. And she had something called the Child Safety Pledge, which was a foundation focused on child sexual abuse prevention, primarily through storytelling and media. So I came in to not only help run the foundation as president, but also to work with her on creating the first ever investment model and matrix for investing in or divesting from child sexual abuse prevention in both the public and private markets. Always happy to dive in more and talk about that. And then that kind of brings us to today. So left the Child Safety Pledge a little while ago, but continue my efforts through an extension called the Child Safety Coalition, of which the Child Safety Pledge is a member. It's a coalition of some of the greatest organizations in the child sexual abuse prevention space, working on a theory of change very much specifically around that idea of media and awareness leading to better outcomes for children. Because in short, with child sexual abuse prevention, part of the issue is we just don't talk about it. And so we've got to break through that wall before we can get into some of the deeper levels of solve. Today, I also have my own company called NES Impact, where I work with typically either family offices and their principals or some other founder-led businesses to either help them create from the start, a social impact first brand, sometimes with larger companies to spin out a social impact oriented subsidiary, and sometimes to use social impact as a means and mechanism for driving growth, which is always an interesting challenge. And then I'm also working on my own project called Notamore. In Latin, when you break that apart, it's no timor or no fear, because I have a singular thematic to my life, which is to remove fear from everyday life, whether I do that as a founder, as a storyteller, as a philanthropist, that has to be the main purpose and outcome. And so Nottamore is a venture studio with one of my projects as the first project within the studio that is essentially focused on removing fear from everyday life and primarily removing the fear of the economy, not having enough money for the future. And so we've actually created, through some financial engineering, a first of its kind platform for giving loans essentially and credit to individuals who have just lost their job. I could run you through all the statistics all day, but bottom line is Americans have almost no liquid savings and they have a ton of debt. And so if you're out of a job for 30 days, you're pretty much out of money. And if you don't have a job, guess what? No one will lend to you, right? So we've created a non-predatory lending vehicle that says, we get it's a tough time, you're probably running a little short of cash, and the reality is you need this money more than the billionaire who's taking out a loan to fund his next yacht purchase. But we also understand that you're a high credit risk as viewed by the banks, and we don't want to come in and offer you ridiculous terms. Let's actually do it with a human-centered, human-first approach to lending, and remove some of that fear of the economy that, oh my God, I lost my job. Okay, I can be fine for the next 6 months now. I can still contribute to my 401k. I can still pay my COBRA. I can still have income continuity. So that's what Nottamore is really focused on today. And then as a final thing, I know there's a lot going on in my life, I have a foundation, both a family foundation called the St. Clair Family Foundation, and then another little offshoot of that called the Next Men Foundation. And the Next Men Foundation is what's most active, and that's primarily focused on bringing men and boys into the rights and causes of women. Not to disrupt, not to take over, but to do one thing that I don't think men do, which is to show up and to listen. We don't take enough time to actually sit down and listen to women and say, how can we be good partners? How can we help? So we bring groups of powerful men together because, for better or worse, men still hold an outsized amount of power and control in this country. And we do one thing. We say, let's listen to Rosemary. We want to hear your story. And for 1 hour, those 15 powerful men can't talk. All they do is listen to your story and how we can be better partners to you and whatever it is you're passionate about. And then we show up to events. We sit on boards. We invest in, and we become true partners to women and whatever those rights and causes are that are most important to them. That's my day. It's a little busy.
That's great. It's great. I have lots of things to dig into here. So social impact investing. We launched a company during the pandemic called Ignite Social Impact. It's a crowd equity platform where we are going to be investing in deep tech for social impact. So it's very interesting, taking advantage of the new SEC rules. But you're one of the trailblazers in this space. So I would love to dig in more about the Child Safety Pledge. Could you tell us a little bit more about that one?
Happily. So unfortunately, I have had way too many, almost exclusively women in my life, who are survivors of sexual abuse, both child sexual abuse and adult sexual abuse. It's a huge passion point for me. And so when I met Rachelea, I guess now two or so years ago, we're both members of a group called Nexus. We started talking about our mutual passion for, you know, prevention of sexual assault and specifically child sexual abuse prevention. She asked me to join her advisory board to, as my old boss would say, share my confusion around media and marketing and raising awareness. And so I joined in that capacity. And then for a variety of reasons, as I mentioned earlier, both me sort of in a desire to step out of a role into one that's more active, not talking about impact, but doing impact, and her just having that to have a need for a senior executive to pop in and help, I joined up. And so the Child Safety Pledge's primary theory of change was to use media and storytelling as a primary means and mechanism for raising awareness around child sexual abuse. Child sexual abuse is a massive problem, and most people don't know how massive it is. I was shocked, even as someone that felt that they were sort of aware of the issue. I was shocked because I'd never dug into the numbers. Let me run them through you real quick. So 1 in 8 children under the age of 18 will be sexually abused in some way, whether that's bad touch, exploitation, chronic rape, whatever it might be, they will be sexually abused in some way. 1 in 8 in the United States by the time they're 18. Imagine what the numbers look like in the Sudan or in Southeast Asia and other areas where there's less protection for children. So if you're looking at 1 in 8 children, that means pretty much every generation, and let's say a generation turns over every 20 years, there's somewhere between 8 and 12 million children that will be sexually abused. 1 in 3 to 1 in 4 girls, 1 in 12 to 1 in 15 boys are the usual numbers that are tossed around. And it costs the economy 50 some odd billion dollars per year in things like lost wages, ongoing psychological trauma, et cetera, related to that abuse. So just because it happened when you were seven doesn't mean that it's over for you as an individual, and there's not an easy solve for it. But when you start looking at some of the statistics around awareness, it's just not there. It's not a story that, at least even until recently, is spoken of. And I, as a former member of the media, and in some ways still a current member of the media, have some grave concerns about the way the media portrays and talks about child sexual abuse. I get why we do the man bites dog kind of stories, but the reality is it's not the Boy Scouts. It's not the Catholic Church. It's not the serial predators like a Larry Nassar. Yes, they exist. And yes, predation does happen there. You know where most of it happens? You know who mostly perpetrates it? The men in your life that live in your own home. About 80% by our reckoning of child sexual abuse occurs within a home or family residence, not necessarily your home, but a home of, say, a trusted family friend, a tutor, somebody like that that's exceptionally well known to the child. Mm-hmm. That's where the abuse generally is occurring. And it's typically men and boys, about 90, 92% against women and girls. And that's part of the big reason why we don't talk about it. And it's even worse within insular communities, ultra-Orthodox Jewish communities. Rachele comes from an Orthodox background. I'm Jewish as well. And so we were talking a lot with Orthodox communities because they don't want to discuss it. We'll handle it internally. Native communities, historically Black colleges, one of the most difficult places to actually come forward and prosecute a sexual assault. So anyway, the whole idea here is that through media and awareness, we can actually create better outcomes for kids. And so we did a lot of storytelling on one hand. There's a great PSA on childsafetypledge.org that you can watch that's beyond emotional. If you don't cry, you don't have a soul on this one. And then working with major movie and TV productions to inject child sexual abuse prevention into their storylines. What are the signs, symptoms, and things that you can do to be aware? To give you a simple example, not only is it about saying the names of your body parts to your children, right, as a parent, and we typically targeted parents as the primary enforcers of this. You can say things like penis and vagina, and it's okay. It's clinical. It's biological. That's what they're called. Don't make up funny names for it for your children. Use the right terms. And beyond that, you know, I consider myself, I guess, a progressive guy, but there are some things that are like even a little overclocked on the wokeness scale for me. And like one of them was, I was reading this story about, oh, you know, ask your child permission before you change their diaper. And I'm like, come on, like that's really silly. And I had someone within the child sexual abuse prevention community come to me and say, do you think that that is for the child? No, it's for you. And I said, what do you mean? I said, it's about creating a culture of consent in your household from day one. So when you start asking your child permission to change their diaper, guess what you're going to do when they're a little older? Ask permission to brush their hair, help them change their clothes, help them go to the potty, whatever it might be. And guess what happens while when another adult, say in a future part of their life, comes in and touches them in a way without permission? That child immediately triggers to know that that's wrong, because I've always been asked permission, and they have an idea and a structure of consent in their house. So it was injecting those kind of storylines. And then on the other side, we had something called Group 2050, which was focused on eradicating sexual abuse or minimizing it by about 30% by the year 2050. And that was primarily focused on using investment. A lot of wealthy people out there putting a lot of money primarily towards climate change. And it's not to minimize climate change, but man, do they get a lot of cash. $1 to $3 trillion of the ESG and impact dollars, then there's about $12 trillion in the United States, goes towards climate change, which costs the US about $50 billion in ongoing issues related to climate change. Well, guess what? As I mentioned earlier, child sexual abuse has the same amount of economic harm and impact. And guess how much money is invested in child sexual abuse prevention? Zero. Yeah. Philanthropically, we get about $50 million a year dedicated to child sexual abuse prevention, while we give about $50 billion to education as a whole. So there's a lot of these various disconnects. So we wanted to give wealthy family offices, large institutions, primarily on the bond public market side and on the venture capital and private equity private market side, a tool, a model from which they could analyze child sexual abuse prevention within their portfolios and either invest more directly in things that were doing prescriptive good or divest from things that were doing prescriptive harm. And I can give you a lot of examples of those, but that was the main model. Still going strong today. Very proud of the work that we did there.
Has more money gone into it?
Since my time, in terms of the child safety pledge, personally, yes. In terms of child sexual abuse prevention overall, no. Those numbers remain generally the same. In terms of our ability to get more investment, Yeah. Mm-hmm. So we were successful in getting what we called assets under influence. So yeah. We never touched the money. We weren't money managers. We wanted to influence asset holders and asset owners to change their way of thinking. And we got about $150 million real held assets at both the institutional and private family office level to adopt our model and put that into their investment framework.
So did you coin that assets under influence? I love that term.
Thank you. I think we did. We came up with it. I don't know if somebody beat us to the punch, but assets under influence was an idea that we had.
That's great. So I would like to hear more about this Next Men Foundation. What inspired you to create that?
So it's a great question. So I have a daughter. She's about 6.5 years old as we sit here speaking today. And so a couple of years ago, as I was looking at her beautiful little eyes, I think she was 4 years old at the time, I said to myself, what is the greatest gift I could give to my daughter, you know, when she goes out into the wider world, whether that's in college or graduating from college? And I said, yeah, man, I could get her a car, I guess, buy her an apartment, you know, set her up in something. I said, I meant this with great sincerity, or could I provide her a more just and gender equal world? And can I be a part of that solution? And I want to say this is about the time that the Stanford rape case was occurring, or was at least being hotly debated. Might have been a little bit after that, but that was ringing in my head, thinking about that scenario. And I said, you know what, I think I can do this. And so I started to look at all the different issues related to women and sexual abuse, sexual violence, sexual harassment and discrimination in the workplace. And I came up with a couple of ideas and vetted them through. Several people were very helpful with me going through this idea. And originally it was called the Fathers of Daughters. And the idea was to get sort of the fathers of daughters. We've got skin in the game, right? Like, it's our kid. And as I started to think through it, a lot of people came to me and said, like, it's a great idea, but it really should be more inclusive and expansive. There's a lot of people that would want to help on this from the male perspective. And so that's how we eventually came to the idea of the Next Men and how we could bring men into the rights and causes of women without being disruptive, without wanting to push and bully our way in and take over. And you just look at the statistics, right? I may be misquoting this a little bit, but I think in the Fortune 500 today, there are 15 female CEOs. Might be misquoting that, but I think that's about right. Talk about power and influence being swayed in one particular direction, right? Yeah. So if that's the scenario, then men, yes, we may be part of the problem, but there are too many organizations out there, I think, that are doing finger pointing. It's you have to correct your behavior. Why not make us part of the solution set, given that also we have this amount of large excise power? So now we're focused on sort of the next generation of men, whether young, old, parent, non-parent, whatever it might be, and saying, how can we be helpful? And I'll tell you what really inspired this specific idea. I was at an amazing event on a rooftop in New York a year or two ago for something called the Equality League. The Equality League is focused on gender equality, specifically in sports. They had Judge Aquilina there as a speaker. She was the judge, if you recall, in the Larry Nassar case, and she gave every single one of those girls a chance to have their say and to face down their violator. And I thought, I mean, she was so powerful. She's so off the cuff, not like you would expect a judge at all, whipcrack smart, but at the same time, just like someone you'd want to grab a beer with. And I'm looking around and there's 200 people there and we're talking about gender equality in sports and there's 5 guys in the entire audience. And I'm like, this doesn't work. If we're talking about gender equality, and I'm going to make an assumption that many of the folks on the board of USA Olympics, USA Gymnastics are guys, and there's none of us here, women can't do it alone. It'll take too long. We as men have to step up and say, we're here too. So it breaks down into 3 things. First is showing up, being at those events, gaining information, understanding what these issues are, because I bet you most men actually don't know. Then it's listening, right? And we talked about this a little earlier. It's about sitting down for an hour, a group of powerful, influential men, and saying, tell us your story, what you're passionate about, the things that you've experienced, and how we can be helpful. How can I change my workplace into a more gender equal world? How can I invest more in women? How can I just understand the little microaggressions and triggering things that I might do as an individual? Like, I can tell you, I check myself now. Whenever I would interview a woman in the past and I would end the conversation, I would always say, oh, it's so lovely to meet you. And I never said that to a guy. And I said, I am, even in a small way, treating a woman fundamentally differently because she's a woman, and that's not okay, right? I have to figure out sort of a more gender normalized way to approach the end of a conversation. And so we listen to these things and these amazing women. And then finally, we put our money where our mouth is. We sit on boards, we make investments and donations, and we show up in that way as well. It's still very early days, website coming soon, still figuring out the most effective way to make change overall. But our hope is that through some trackable mechanisms, by the time my daughter in 12 or so years is off into the wider world, her dad will be able to look her in the eye and say, I made the world a little bit of a better place for you and hopefully for a wider world of women. Go enjoy.
So if anyone listening has any ideas for Neil, write them in the comment section. And do you have a URL planned up?
Yeah, so it'll be nextmenfoundation.org. It's not live just yet, literally in the process of coding it out. You'll be able to find some more information on neilsinclair.com shortly after August 15th. On there, we'll have some more details. And then the website for Next Men will actually come out probably around towards the end of August or mid-September.
Your daughter's very lucky.
She's
clearly very special.
Thank you.
So showing up, gaining, learning more information about gender inequality and listening are the three major things. And have you hosted any meetings yet?
So we were supposed to have our first meeting in March.
Yeah.
As you can imagine, that was pushed off a little bit. We've had some virtual convenings with our guys to kind of just ask, like, focus group wise, what's the best way to go about this? Would you show up? How would you want to be most effective in taking things away? And then our plan is to hopefully, fingers crossed, convene our first in-person event in September or October, assuming public health crises abate.
Okay. Well, I have some guys for you.
please do.
You were mentioning about karma impact when you started impact investing. How did you choose what you're investing in?
Yeah, so Karma Impact was our media platform to talk about next generation impact investing. I provided a bit of strategic counsel to our parent company's investment arm called Timeless Capital. Mm-hmm. And that was run through the Hinduja family, single family office, primarily through one single family principal. That had a fair amount of interest in impact investing, but also was a little bit more sort of pure capitalist at the end of the day. My investing personally, just run through my own capital, tends to be purely impact oriented. So through that, I'm invested or an equity holder in several companies. I'll give you one example. There's a company called Palgo, P-A-L-G-O, out of Peru, run by a great guy, older for an entrepreneur, but wise even beyond his years, ex-military officer, Air Force officer, and ran international operations as the CIO for Ericsson and a couple of other major telecoms. And he came up with a really simple solve. And the reason that I ended up becoming involved with him was because I had a similar idea, but said, man, it's too much work, but I wonder if someone's doing it. There's a friend of mine, Jeff Stewart, he runs a company called Lendo, which does credit scoring for people in the third world, the so-called bottom billion, that don't have traditional means of being credit scored. So they use things like social networks and whatever have you in Southeast Asia, Africa, Latin America, and so forth and so on. And I said, I wonder, we were doing a story on South Africa while I was at Karma Impact. And I don't know if you know this, but in South Africa and in many places in sub-Saharan Africa, the idea of credit for low and middle income people doesn't exist. Mm-hmm. You either have the cash or you don't. Mm-hmm. They have something there called the Stockfeldt system, I believe it's called. It's kind of like a social security system that you can have ready access to, though. And so there actually are a fair amount of, quote unquote, relatively cash rich people in South Africa. But they can't walk into a store for something that they might need to have impact on their life, say a stove to help with cooking, and walk out with that unless they put the cash down today. And the merchants aren't willing to offer financing themselves. So you have to be already rich to get a loan. And I said, man, wouldn't it be cool to create like a firm or Klarna for the third world, for the bottom billion, to provide ready credit and access for the things that people need? And I said, man, it's such a great idea, but I mean, I'm like, I've got too many irons in the fire. I'll never be able to pull this off. And I've not personally stepped foot in sub-Saharan Africa. I don't even know what I don't know there. Mm-hmm. So I said, if anybody knows who's doing that right now, my friend Jeff's gonna know. And lo and behold, Jeff is, I believe, an investor and a partner with Palgo, and he introduced me to Andrew Kozowski, who runs it. And we hit it off immediately. And like I said, I've ended up becoming an equity holder in it subsequently. And just what they're doing is essentially merchant side financing, kind of like Affirm does, for the bottom billion, only though for specific things that may drive somebody's life forward. So to use the example I used earlier, if you need a stove to cook or to heat your home, you can go and buy that. You cannot go and buy a TV because you want a 72 inch in your living room. Yet they only do the financing for that, and they're doing quite well. So that was part of the impetus, was to find things that really have measurable, meaningful, data-backed impact and change on a global scale. That's why I became involved with Palgo. On the other side, I'm also an equity holder in a company called ScholarMe, started by a young man. I fell in love with his story the minute I met him. I was a venture judge at the Next Generation Summit a few years ago, and this kid walks in, kind of shy, but you could tell immediately, this guy knows how to code. Like, there's just like something about him. You're like, he's like, not Steve Jobs, more Steve Wozniak-esque, right? Just like he knows how to put weird things together. He's a wizard of technology. Maybe not the best speaker, maybe not the best person to be the CEO of the company, but man, he's really got something special. And he laid out this vision for essentially a common application for scholarships. And he'd created a natural language processing system that essentially allows you to go and fill out one application, and then that cross applies to thousands of scholarships all at once. Great. So hundreds of hours of work versus now 3 hours of work to get similar results. Lots of interesting things in the model I could go on. Not only was there social impact in that, because there's so many folks out there that struggle to pay for college, mm-hmm. but beyond that, the young man that is and was running the company then, a young Black man from the inner city of Baltimore, he was telling me the story of how he literally used to go and like hack into Verizon to get ready, reliable access to Wi-Fi to be able to code out his projects because he didn't have it in his home. And I had actually spent like a year out in the Bronx doing a story for Karma focused on a very specific number, 57.5%, which is the rolling 4-year average graduation rate from high school in the Bronx. And by the way, that's all the Bronx, including Riverdale and Sputin Dival. Take that out, and in the South Bronx, that number is closer to 30%.
Wow.
Like, blows your mind, right?
Yeah.
And one of the biggest things that we talked about why this graduation rate was so abysmal, was that there wasn't ready, reliable access to the internet. How are you supposed to do your homework in the modern world? And we had actually talked with a coffee shop owner there who wanted to be sort of the Magic Johnson, bring Starbucks into the Bronx, but I want to do it myself. I want to make my own version of Starbucks, that sort of Bronx born and raised, thanks to Majora Carter, and it's the Boogie Down Grind Cafe. And she had franchised that out a bit. And one of the things that she found was that both students and teachers were using that coffee shop to get access to the internet and find a safe third space. So I knew this kid's story in a pretty intimate way from my personal experience spending some time out in the Bronx. And I was like, I get where you're coming from. You're so awesome. You're so smart. You know, let me become involved in this and drive this forward. And they just graduated, I think, last year from Y Combinator and are doing very, very well. So those are some of my primary criteria. It's a little bit founder-led, but it's more so about the actual impact of what the organization can do and how those outcomes can be effectively measured at scale. And both of those organizations really hit it home for me.
So how do you measure the impact?
Yeah, so luckily for both of these organizations, it's pretty direct, right?
Pretty clear, right.
Yeah. It's pretty clear. Like, and that's, I think, the grand difficulty, right, of most social impact is like, how do we quantify this?
Yes.
Which is why, like in child sexual abuse prevention, where our main measurement is awareness, listen, it's like a pre and post activity survey, but it still feels very soft. Mm-hmm. You can show measure, but it's not the same as, say, working with Palgo, where you're able to say, here's X number of people that have specifically been helped by this. Now, how that's helped them is the one metric beyond that we don't get to, right? Like, I can't say there's been enough people in Peru helped by Palgo in a defined geographic area to measure, have their health outcomes over a 30-year period improved because they had more reliable access to things that improve their quality of life. Mm-hmm. They were able to buy an air conditioning unit or a stove or air filtration and water filtration systems. I can't say that yet. And that's the other frustration with impact is sometimes you have to wait. Yeah. Right? You have to, like, oh my gosh, patience, right? So you have to wait 20, 30 years to see and do it on a very controlled basis. So some of it is a bit of a leap of faith. With ScholarMe, not only was there my sort of direct personal impact with this young man, you know, knowing that now he's doing something that's going to pull him out of a vicious cycle of poverty and violence into a way that is going to lead him to great success. So that was a small part of it, and that was a micro impact. But the larger impact is going to be on so many people that now I know, and they've just sort of really rolled out the full product over the next several years are going to write in and be like, I couldn't have gone to college if it wasn't for you, right? And now we're going to have that specific metric. And we all know there's been enough time to know that if you go to college, your earning power and your societal mobility potential goes massively up. Mm-hmm. But to your audience and anyone listening, if you know better, more effective ways to create data models around measuring impact on a short-term and long-term basis, I'm always very interested. And I think most of us in the impact world absolutely are, because it's the one thing that we're often missing when we're trying to do our investment diligence. And sometimes you just have to assume, yeah, which is always dangerous. But I think with these two, it's going to work out very well.
Yeah, with Ignite Social Impact, we're looking at a lot of different models about how do you measure impact. Or we're going to probably have all the companies create KPIs themselves and leading and lagging indicators to measure consistently, long-term, short-term, because it's not a really one-size-fits-all type of thing.
No, it's absolutely not. And that was one of the things that we found was great difficulties going back to the sort of child sexual abuse prevention. You'd think there'd be statistics up and around the corner around that, but guess what? There's not. One of the best statistics you should have is a government-mandated statistic, one of the only government-mandated statistics under Title IX, which requires, oddly, the administrators to report back any incidences at the K through 12 level of sexual abuse, harassment, or discrimination. Well, here's the rub with that. First of all, it's a garbage in, garbage out situation, right, primarily because the same people who would be penalized for having too much sexual abuse or sexual discrimination in their schools are the principal and the superintendent. Guess what? They're the same people responsible for reporting it.
Right.
Talk about like, they could lose their job, they could lose funding, they're going to get under closer scrutiny. What is their incentive to not sort of handle it quietly internally and never report back? And here's how we validated that. We looked at a couple of studies. I'm forgetting the exact numbers, but I'll give you paraphrases of it. Something like one in 20 schools, or even more than that, I'm sorry, one in like 2,000 schools were saying that they had experienced recent, within the last year or two, incidents of sexual abuse or sexual discrimination, at least according to the extracted statistics filed with Title IX. And I believe it's run through the Civil Rights Commission. Then they did a survey, and this is from a third party group. They went out and they spoke to people, K through 12, actual students who said, have you experienced this in some way that should have been reportable back? And guess what? It was like one in five had said that they had experienced that. There was such a disconnect. Yeah. And so there was a complete inability for us to have any good data around that to even track movement, because there's just no good data coming in. There's no IoT sensor level data that we can really utilize within child sexual abuse, because we can't ask somebody, hey, can you put a sensor or a camera in every corner of your home so we can track every one of your movements and see if your kid is being sexually abused or if you're an abuser? Like, it just doesn't work like that. And so even that was one of our biggest questions as we formed the investment model was, first of all, to your point, we have to create custom KPIs. There is absolutely no one-size-fits-all model. And there's not even one-size-fits-all model within sexual abuse on a state-by-state, locality level, because each area was experiencing different problems. The child sexual abuse issues in rural Missouri versus the inner city of Manhattan are exceedingly different, right? And so they need to be measured in very different ways, both in terms of, you know, harm and outcome and future prevention, and done on a long period of time. So we spent a lot of time thinking about that. And unlike, say, climate change now, where there's both government mandated reporting for public companies, but it's also just become sort of a de facto reporting. I want to release my carbon footprint because I want to show you the good things that we're doing. And there's not even that social pressure right now for companies, schools, or individuals to release those statistics. And the few statistics we do have are mostly poor data overall. So anyway, it is a constant and consistent problem within the social impact space. So again, I come up with the idea that sometimes it just has to be a little bit of faith and a little bit of anecdotes, and that can get you through the day.
Right. And I think that even there's a stigma for children. If you ask them if they've been sexually abused, they might say no, just because they have their own stigma. I went to school with a girl who, she was sexually abused, and her mom told her not to let it happen again.
Mm-hmm.
And of
you
course
use
it did.
Well, sorry, please go ahead.
No, instead of enforce it did. So then she didn't tell anyone anymore.
Mm-hmm. So you used the perfect word, which is stigma. And that was one of the things that we were fighting in the extreme, was this idea of stigma, social, familial, societal stigma around this issue. that is one of the biggest reasons we believe, and to some extent we know, that this is not talked about. And in some ways, this is a strange thing to say in the child sexual abuse world. The Jeffrey Epsteins and Larry Nassers of the world did the broader spectrum of child sexual abuse prevention a favor, because they were so egregious in their activities that they brought it to the public light, that the media had to pay attention to it. And so it's become a slightly more normalized conversation. We always said we wanted to create, make child sexual abuse prevention a normal but never normalized conversation. And I think through the activities of these horrible monsters that it started to make people say, maybe this is a real thing. Maybe the kid's not making it up. Maybe I should learn how to be more sympathetic and to watch for signs and symptoms. So in that regard, you hit that word right on the head, because there was and remains to this day, especially in certain communities, a massive stigma around talking about child sexual abuse in any way, shape, or form. So, you know, that's part of what the walls that we're trying to break down and ultimately prevent, in the way that, you know, as silly as it sounds, like the way Lady Gaga did for mental health care. Mm-hmm. She made it okay to say, I'm not okay. And in child sexual abuse, another statistic for you, 60% of the abuse is never reported. The numbers we're going off of is primarily on reported adjudicated abuse, most that we don't even know about.
I think it's probably 50% of the women.
Oh, 100%. It takes about 17 years on average for mostly women, it's about 90, 92% women that are victims of child sexual abuse, to disclose. It takes 17 years if they ever disclose at all, which is, again, as we cited earlier, quite a rarity.
Well, you have a lot of causes. I'm really interested also in Nottamore.
Thank you. Like, so
what inspired you to create Nottamore?
Yeah, so Nottamore, as I said earlier, you know, no timor, no fear in Latin, is the culmination of a lot of time spent thinking about one simple emotion, which is the emotion of fear. And how can I remove fear from everyday life? Part of this comes out of my own experiences, knowing where fear has led to inaction, which has led to regret. And I take sort of the Jewish philosophy of living my life, which is not to maximize outcome, but to minimize regret. And through that, you also maximize outcome. So I said, all right, there's a lot of people probably experiencing same and much worse fears than I am, whether those are fears of economy, fears of the unknown, fears of the future. And there's actually a great study that's done every year, and this is the sort of the data that I use to prompt where I would place my flag on the fear spectrum, done by Chapman University. It's called the Survey or the Index of American Fears. And it goes back about 10 or 15 years. And within that, there's a lot of chess pieces of fear that gets played left, right, and otherwise. So you'll see 10 years ago, there was a much larger fear of X than a fear of Y today. The biggest fears today are around climate change, political corruption, which seems so strange in America, though perhaps now more so than ever. But there was one fear, as I sort of did a quick data analysis on it, that stayed consistent in the top five, going all the way back to the origination of the survey. And that was the fear of not having enough money for the future. And so I term that the fear of the economy. Mm-hmm. And so I said, how can I be part, and I've experienced that fear personally, by the way, right? I have been down more than once to my last $5 in my bank account when running my own companies. I've in fact gone below my last $5 and have run into deficits in my bank accounts to make things happen. They've worked out ultimately, but I know that mortal fear, right?
And by the way, just for everybody listening, if you're not viewing this, he's Neil's sitting in Miami, and there's boats going behind him on the water. It's beautiful. So he's got $5 in pockets now.
I'm very lucky to have more than $5 now, but having felt that mortal fear, though, I also know that I never want to experience that again. So that's a huge motivator for me, right? And I think for a lot of us that you know, grew up, you know, whether we had financial security or not, the fear of not going back to those painful scenarios, you know, that where we were down to our last two nickels to rub together, are huge motivators for us. And so anyway, getting back to Nottamore, aside from that, now having analyzed what I think is the most prominent or at least consistent fear of Americans, typically about 45 to 50% of Americans were saying that was a big fear for them. The other side of it was that many folks are actually experiencing inaction, or failure as a result of fear. It's one of our most powerful emotions. And I said, man, I bet that we can live in such a more beautiful and self-actualized world if we extract fear from the equation. So that was the genesis of Nottamore. And as I went through, I looked at a variety of different models to remove fear of the economy. The first one I came on was the idea of unemployment. And I'll tell you, listen, I have in the past had a file for unemployment. I've been the guy with his hand out saying, like, I need some help right now. So I know what that's like. And I also know how bad the actual setup is in New York State, in Florida, in California, everywhere. It's not good. If you make slightly more than the median income, which is about 50% of us, and you're laid off, you probably have $6,000 in the bank account if you're an average American, of liquid assets, and $110,000 of serviceable annual debt. Right? So you're looking, and that's probably about $5,000 to $6,000 of monthly payments, depending on how good your credit score is. You're out of money pretty much the day you're out of a job, right? After you get that last paycheck. And severance is kind of, it still exists, but it's not as robust as it once was. So I said, all right, how can we remove this fear where there is not a great government backstop? You know, in New York State, for example, you get $504 a week. Not horrible and pretty good, actually, compared to other states, assuming that you meet that maximum amount of income. But it takes a long time to get. You have to wait 30 days typically to get, you know, to be able to even file for it. Then you have to wait a few weeks, and you're probably already making those hard decisions about whether or not I can afford my kids' school fees or to get them a toy or to buy medicine and groceries for the household. And you're starting to have to make some of those decisions that lead to fear and anxiety and negative health outcomes. You know, we don't want to tell our spouses about, you know, these things. Like, there's so much that goes into it. And then also you look in major metro areas or even in sort of mid-metro areas, and most people, about 60 to 70% are what are called rent burdened, right? They're not homeowners, and they're experiencing rent burden by having a rent that's typically that is more than 70% of their take-home pay. So now you're looking at a mass amount of evictions. And so there's all these things that go into this lack of income continuity. And as a final statistic around that, for basically every $10,000 of income that you earn, it takes 1 to 2 months of looking for a job to be able to replace that income. So if you make $100,000 a year, it could be 10 to 20 months before you can find a job at that same or comparable level. Mm-hmm. Could be less, could be more, but that's kind of the overall average. So anyway, started looking at this issue from the idea of unemployment insurance. And a couple of companies in the past had kind of attempted to do unemployment insurance from a private market perspective. Mm-hmm. They had all failed. I actually just talked to one of the founders of one of them the other day. Simple reason is the way that you price the risk is so high relative to the people that need it that they wouldn't be able to afford the risk. Right. And the people that can afford the risk are the people that have enough money and savings that they don't need private unemployment insurance. So the model falls apart. Mm-hmm. So we started looking at it more so from a perspective of what I call a springing universal basic income. When you are most in need, so you've lost your job and you need income continuity, it's not only the government's responsibility to provide you with that, say, $1,000 or $2,000 a month just because you exist as an American citizen, but it's something that the private markets can come into too through a very interesting credit model. I am now going to lend money to you despite the fact that I know you are unemployed. I'm going to help you find a job. I'm going to give you a 6 to 12 month grace period to even start paying back the loan at a non-predatory interest rate, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. That is a greenfield market that no bank or investor has ever wanted to touch. Yet, if you look at the statistics today, there's 1.4 to 1.6 million new Americans filing for unemployment just in the past week. Yeah. There's a lot of people struggling out there. And what does that do? Every day, every week, every month that you don't contribute to your 401k makes it more and more difficult to retire in good shape. You're now probably looking at paying for COBRA. What does COBRA cost? $1,000 a month, $2,000 a month, whatever it might be, depending on what plan you're on. That's untenable for most people. And guess what? We're in the middle of a pandemic. So not a great time to not have your COBRA care, even though there are some government backstops to that. You know, so there's so much that goes into this that I wanted to remove that fear of the economy, that fear of a lack of income continuity at whatever level you wanted, and just be a good human-centered person about it. How can we do this from a human-centered design where we say to our investors, even like, is it okay for you that we're not going to make as much money as our competitors because we're not going to charge 15% interest rates on this? Can you lend us money or do off-balance sheet lending to us at 1% so we can go out and maybe get 3 or 4% back on it? So you're still making some money, right? We're doing a little interest rate arbitrage, but the person that's getting that money, 3-4% is not nothing, but it's not enough. It's not so much that it's going to be like, oh my God, like I just took out a $10,000 loan and now I really am going to pay back $30,000. You know, there's a risk premium that goes into it, but doing it in a way that it's like, takes into account that human beings are on the other side of the transaction. And that's really why we started Nautimore. So that's the first project, my project within this, but it is a venture studio. So I'm looking to either invest in or co-found a variety of other fear removal startups that would sit within the framework of Nautimore. Things like, you know, helping folks get their down payment for their house, right? So few Americans, especially next gens, millennials and Gen Zers, can't afford the down payment at 20% on a $500,000, even, you know, $200,000 home. Mm-hmm. There are so many people that are rent burdened, as we talked about, and there's a lot of economic solves for that. There's a variety of things that I would like to do to make people's lives easier. It's not a fund, it really is a venture studio. Try to work with co-founders, young, old, or otherwise, that have experienced things personally to make the lives of their fellow citizens and global citizens a little bit better and a little less fearful.
Very good. We have the child safety. We have removal of fear. Love it. You're hitting on, you're making men better. all these great things that you're doing.
We're trying.
Yeah. You mentioned briefly insurance brokerage. Mm-hmm. So I was the head of strategy at Marsh & McLennan. Yeah, across all their different lines. It was fun when we were trying to create an electronic brokerage. So you've been an entrepreneur. You've had $5 in your pocket. What's the secret to becoming a successful entrepreneur?
Very simple answer. Obsession is the only way through. I apologize to my wife constantly, and she actually co-founded my first company, and then she'll say that she quit. I'll say I had to let her go. It just didn't work out working with family. I wrote an article years ago for Under 30 CEO about how to mix love and business. Most couples that successfully co-founded a business end up getting a divorce, like literally the day after the business exits. The couple that founded Flickr, for example, the husband actually went on to found Slack subsequently, but like the day after Flickr sold, like they pretty much got divorced and went their own way. Both hugely successful, but just it puts so much strain and stress on you. So anyway, that's just a little aside. So obsession is the only way through. And the reason I apologize to my wife is like, I actually have put off projects, not because I'm a procrastinator in any way, but because I know once I get into something, I have blinders on. And so I've actually really specifically gone through and like set forward like my wheel of happiness, all the things that I need to do to make my life feel self-actualized. And so that I plan out my day hour by hour. So I make sure that I pick my head up and still talk to my wife and my kids and I'm still there and present so that I'm not, you know, we all admire Steve Jobs and Elon Musk and others, but we also hear the horror stories about how they're so single-minded. And I don't want to be that guy, right? But obsession really is only the way. So when I start a project like Nautimore, or any of these other things that I'm talking about, I apologize to my wife and I say, you're probably not going to see me for like a month while I get this started. Eventually I'll come back and I'm there, but I'm going to be locked in the bedroom or wherever, just working through these things, because the only thing that makes you successful is outright obsession. You can't sort of be half in and half out on a project, whether as an investor or as an actual operator. And so, you know, for anybody that's looking to start a business out there, you know, this can't be a sideline for you, right? This has to be something that you're either all in or you're not. And you have to be living, breathing, drinking it every single day. And that's the only way to also edge out and elbow out your competitors. And on top of all that, you have to have enough personal and financial risk tolerance in some ways to be able to say that I may dedicate 2 years of my life of obsession with this, and I'm going to give up a lot of emotionally and financially and otherwise to make this happen, and it still might not work. Yeah. That's the scariest part, right? Because obsession is the only way to do it, but it doesn't guarantee success. I'm actually writing a book right now on the art and science of failure. It's called Intriguing Ruins, and tell some of the stories of my own failures, which have been probably the most heuristic elements of my life, and other people's failures as well. Because the reality is that success is stochastic. Success is random as all get up, right? As an example, 1 in 10 venture-backed startups succeed. 1 in 10 investments from a venture capital firm actually go to pay back the other 9 failures in that portfolio. Mm-hmm. 1 in 10 movies recoup their investment. one in 10 fall TV shows get to 100 episodes, and so forth and so on. There's this magic ratio of one in 10 for whatever reason that exists out there. Yet what do we try to do in every sort of self-help book out there? Model success. Well, guess what? Success is the random factor. What if we could actually start to quantify and model failure so that we could understand it to at least maximize our potential for success, but still knowing that success has a lot of random factors that come into it. So at the end of the day, that's the book that I'm writing and the research that I'm doing, but it also is one of the things that you have to do as a young entrepreneur or founder of a nonprofit is figure out, like, what is my risk tolerance here? Because I'm gonna be obsessed because that's the only way to make it work, but I might still be unlucky. I might have a better competitor out there, Amazon or Netflix or one of the big giants may start to do this. And on top of that, even if I do everything the right way, mm-hmm. I still might lose. If you can't answer that question tolerably for yourself, go. You're best working with somebody else's successful company, because those are the big questions that I think a lot of us fail to ask as we enter into an endeavor.
Well, it sounds like you could also integrate some of your Lattimore in there, because the risk tolerance is confluent with fear, right?
That's exactly right. So risk tolerance is one of those things that is concomitant with the measure of your fear. And oftentimes that's just the fear of failure, the fear of not getting started. So you procrastinate and you push it off. There are so many moments of fear that we experience that ladder up to the equation, the calculus of our risk tolerance, that at the end of the day, you need to do a very sharp self-assessment. By the way, it's not the worst thing in the world to be a fearful person, right? We have our sort of three-part brain, right? We have our like reptilian and mammalian brain. Like, fear exists in our biochemistry for a very specific reason, just to allow us to survive. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, as ostensibly higher ordered animals, we need to be able to overcome that fear through rational thinking and then understand that risk tolerance and how we can just get going. And that's part of the, actually, one other thing within Nottamore is how to overcome some of the simple fears of not getting started, primarily because you do not have the finances to get started. It's really easy. And let me be very clear. I recognize the privilege within myself, right? I often call myself the kid from the cul-de-sac, right? Because, like, I grew up white, cisgender, male, in a relatively affluent family relative to the rest of the country. I was able to go to my parents and get a small loan to start my first company. Didn't work out, still feel badly about that. But at the end of the day, I was able to basically borrow the money to get my real life MBA by starting that business that made me successful in the second business. Most people in this world do not have that opportunity. Mm-hmm. There are several companies that do this now that finance primarily brown and black entrepreneurs, but also other folks that just don't have the ability to go out and raise a friends and family round. That is one of my most frustrating things in the world. When I hear folks, whether in the venture world or the operator world, be like, well, you know, it's a really great idea. Why don't you go out and just get a little bit of capital to get it started and come back when you've got more traction? That is so not everybody's reality, right?
That's what all investors say. They say, just wait till a little bit longer.
I was an advisory board member of a nonprofit called Build, specifically Build NYC, run by an amazing woman, Shamika Olfons. And they primarily mentor, and I was lucky enough to do this, brown and black entrepreneurs, primarily in the Bronx in New York. And they actually also inject it as curriculum into the schools. So you can be a Build fellow and actually take a class in entrepreneurship at a young age. And it gives you just another option as a young person to realize, I could be Mark Zuckerberg. Set aside the fact that he went to Phillips Exeter Academy and had a privileged background, I could be that next person, even though I come from very different circumstances and I am a couple of steps behind because of systemic racism that exists in this country, right? We could go through the statistics around black, brown, female entrepreneurs, and it's just, they're abysmal compared to you know, white men like myself. So the reality is, though, like, just getting $500 or $1,000 or offering a services in kind to a young entrepreneur that comes from a non-privileged background, both financially and because of other demographic factors, to get them started, some type of proof of concept or MVP, man, working with these kids, their hustle, their grit, their determination, because they have, you know, some of us have read, I think it's the Robert Greene book, a book on war, right? They have what's called dying ground. the only way out is through. There is a mountain on the back, on their back, that they can't retreat from, right? It's how the samurai used to fight, right? So they would put the mountain behind them so that they only could fight forward. There was no cowardice. That's their natural metaphysical circumstance. And so these kids are already have all the great fundamental tools of being an entrepreneur. Plus they've experienced things that many of us in the venture and operator world have never experienced, that are problems that require real solves at scale. And so they have amazing solutions, amazing ideas, grit, determination, hustle, all these other things that you need as an entrepreneur. If I ran down like the checklist of characteristics, and the one thing they lack, the one thing they lack is that $1,500 to prototype something out, or the inability to get into a commute to a venture studio, or to find a technical co-founder. That should not be. And so a big part of what we want to do with Nottamore as well is stake those friends and family rounds for folks, you know, and take a position, but also mentor them through that. Because I can tell you, there should be so many startups from underrepresented founders out there that will never come to pass simply because they can't raise, you know, a small amount of capital to get going. That, you can hear the passion in my voice, that frustrates me beyond measure, that that inequity exists in our society today.
Well, I have to tell you something. The future is so bright. We both have to wear shades. Making the world a better place. There you go.
I like it. I like it. Well, thank you for that. So, I don't always wear shades.
I could speak with you all day. You have so many great initiatives that are going to change the world. I really appreciate the insights you've provided today. Is there anything you want to leave the audience with today?
One last thing. It's a question I ask almost everybody I meet. I host a small private member society called The Corsair, and this is actually usually the way that we start our dinners and our cocktail events. There's no wrong answer, by the way. I asked the question from an ancient Irish mythological figure. And I'm sure I'm mispronouncing the name of Cuchulainn is how I heard it. And he said, paraphrasing, "I would but live one day and one night, should my deeds and actions live forever after." And so the question I posit to you is, would you rather live 100 years and have a beautiful, nice life, some money, nice family, but you're not really making an impact on anybody other than that immediate circle of yourself? Or would you rather just live for one day and one night, but change the world in such a fundamental way that people whom you'll probably never meet will have their lives changed fundamentally for the better, but you'll never experience the benefit or even the results of that yourself? Which would you choose? And so I'll leave your audience with that to think about and to determine which side of the equation they would be on.
Excellent. Well, I would choose the latter, personally. Making an impact in the world that I live for. So thank you so much, Neil. You are fantastic.
Thank you so much.
The latter too, I'm sure.
I certainly am as well, but also hope that I could live 100 years. So,
well, you probably had best of both worlds, right?
wouldn't that be nice? Remember, I was a former debater, so I gave no third option. It's just one of the two. But thank you really for inviting me on and allowing me to share my confusion with your audience.
You've been fantastic. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Good day.
Cheers.